So we've been emphasizing relax, receive, and explore the possibility of allowing what's here to be here. Finding that balance of mind where, as Alexa said so beautifully this morning, finding that balance of mind where it feels okay to be with experience. And okay means that we can learn from the experience. Okay doesn't mean it's pleasant. That's often what we go for or think, oh, it's okay because it feels good or it feels okay. But in this practice, really, we are aiming for that place where we can be with it and learn with it. And yet it's not always so easy to be with our experience. And so we do need to find our way to that balance. How do we find our way to that balance? That's what I'd like to talk about tonight, this afternoon, to explore some perspectives, some understandings that can support being with our experience, and some tools, some kinds of things that we can bring in to engage with, other kinds of practices perhaps. And it's always possible in this practice when we're feeling a little bit off kilter. Many of you have been practicing and have tools in your toolkit for working with challenges and difficulties. You've expressed some of them in the room here and in the groups. And when the mind is out of balance, we use our tools to help our mind come back into balance so that we can learn from our experience. And so it's not a problem to pick up another tool or another practice to support the mind to come back into the place where learning is possible. And so that's always possible. You've all got your own kind of tools in your toolkit. And today I'm going to just explore with you, well, some tools that I've learned in this particular practice. As Alexis has been saying, you know, we really are finding our own way with this style of practice. We're respecting our own minds, and we learn about what supports our mind, what supports our capacity to meet experience. And so we learn our way, we find our way with difficulty, we find our way with understanding. And in my years of practice with Saito Utejaniya, there's a few kinds of tools that have come up in that style of practice that I found to be really helpful. And so I'll share some of those this afternoon too. So one of the things that I've learned over the time with Saito Utejaniya is that when there is some kind of challenge happening, a reactivity that feels difficult to be with, sometimes we hold a kind of unseen belief or perspective or view that it's not possibly to just simply be with that. That it's a problem that it's there, you know, that there's something, it's bad practice if it's there. If I'm experiencing this, it means I'm not meditating properly. Anybody recognize that thought? Yeah, so that belief, that view can sometimes get in the way, or it can have us kind of shift to our tools because we don't believe it's even possible to be with that experience. And so that's a piece that I want to point to. Just it's some wisdom. It's a learning that I've gained over my time in practicing in this form. That sometimes we might have a belief that we can't meet something, or that I must be doing something wrong if this is arising. Even in the very recognizing of it, we you know, having that thought, this is what's happening, and you know, I must be doing something wrong. But already, your mind is aware that that thing is happening, because you're having the thought about it happening. And so there's already some awareness around it. And so this is something to check into and kind of connect with. Sometimes we jump more quickly or too quickly sometimes to our tools because of that belief, because we just believe it's not possible to be mindful of something. So that's one thing. One key tool in my toolkit that has developed over the years is that actually it's possible to be mindful of anything that arises. It may not be possible right in this moment, but there's nothing that is arising in our minds that is inherently not possible to be mindful of, except for perhaps non-mindfulness. And even that we can begin to understand in the moment when mindfulness returns. We can get the flavor of what it was like when the mind was not aware. And so there's nothing, no state of mind that's inherently non-mindful. Most of the ways that our mind wanders and gets lost and is non-mindful is connected with certain kinds of states. Familiar habits where we tend to habitually not be mindful. But it's a habit. It's not inherent in that state. And so that's a piece of learning and confidence that I have gained over my time in practice. So some of what I'm going to explore and share is a kind of a review of some of the things we've already said in the last days. So one of the first things that's helpful when there is something challenging arising, some difficulty arising. And so one of the first pieces is, okay, this is something that's arising. It is possible to be mindful of this. So just kind of shoring up that mind that can maybe believe it's possible to be mindful of this. But it is helpful to bring in right view. Consciously, Alexis talked about right view yesterday in the Q&A a little bit, the different kinds of wisdom, and the kind of wisdom of learning and understanding, that first kind of wisdom. The second kind of wisdom where we reflect, we think about what we've learned, bring in actually thoughts about our understanding. And the third kind of wisdom, the actual experience, the understanding itself that we feel, the experience of wisdom, the kind of freedom that we feel when wisdom is operating. So the bringing in the second kind of wisdom, Chintamayapanya is the Pali term for it, the mindfulness or the wisdom of reflection and thinking. This is a useful kind of a tool to bring in around any difficulty. And we've named several of them. I mean, the kind of classic ones that the Buddha points to are, well, this is impermanent. And so this can be a reminder when we're experiencing something that's challenging, just to remember it's impermanent. It's not always here. It comes and goes. Well, that's one kind of reflection we can bring in. This is nature, is Sayadaw's phrasing of what I understand to be the Buddha's reflection on, which he asked us to bring in at times. He said, we should reflect that our experience is, this is not me. This is not mine. This is not who I am. So this is the reflection on not self. And that understanding of not self is deeply connected to the conditioned nature of experience, that everything is just a process tumbling on. It's the natural consequences of what has come before, causes and conditions at play. This is the kind of the one of the simple ways to understand this teaching on, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. There's no entity or a self here in the middle of this being that is somehow stable and still and directing everything. It is all just processes tumbling on. You know, much as a tree grows, a tree, you know, those little tiny, have you seen those little tiny cones? You know, many of you here in California know that those are the cones of the redwood tree. You know, they're about this big, and they make that tree. It's just amazing to think about that and reflect on that. You know, it's the conditions in the seeds in that little cone are the potential for that redwood tree. The conditions coming into being, the right moisture, the somebody not kicking it off the path, or, you know, so just whatever, the conditions, the moisture, the sun, the animals not coming along and eating the sprouts as it starts to grow. Given certain conditions, that seed will grow into a redwood tree. And where does the tree begin, and where, you know, where does the seed end? It's just this flow of conditions. And so very, very like that is our being. We are also nature. The redwood tree, we think of the things out there in the world. That's nature. But we're also nature. We're part of nature. We are also just conditions tumbling on. Just like with that tree, there is no, like, there doesn't have to be a tree being inside of that tree that's making that tree grow and decide how I'm going to grow and how I'm going to branch out. It's conditions that make it do its thing. It may be a little bit humbling to think about us as being that similar, a similar thing, but that is essentially what we are. And Sayadaw offers this reflection, that whole thing kind of encapsulated in what's happening right now. So what's arising right now? What's arising right now? This is nature. If what's arising right now is boredom, this is nature. This is the conditions have come together for boredom to arise. If anger is arising, this is nature. These conditions have come together for anger to arise. Depression, this is nature. I found this phrasing of this wisdom to be very resonant with me. Sayadaw offers it. And, you know, I like to encourage, as Anna mentioned yesterday, you know, the thoughts, the kind of supports, the wisdom that comes up in us. When it comes up in our own words, it's often in some ways more powerful because it's so resonant with us when it comes up in our own language and our own words. In this case, this one for me was very resonant anyway. And so I found that whatever was coming up, often this kind of reflection, this is what's arising. Oh, this is nature. It would just like create some space around the experience so that the mind could be curious about it. It's another way of framing this possibility of learning. When the mind feels curious, there's the possibility of learning. The mind is kind of naturally interested in learning. So this is nature. A useful reflection. Another one that I found useful, the third of the trilogy that the Buddha offers of wisdom reflections. This is dukkha. This is suffering. This one, I think it has a place. It depends on whether this feels useful or not. Again, you know, it's really helpful to try on. Sometimes one flavor of this or another might be more useful. One flavor of these reflections might be more useful than another at any given time. But there were times when, you know, dukkha was actually what was strong in my experience. I was at Shui Yumin at Sayadaw's monastery, and it was about probably 2 weeks into the retreat. First time I was practicing in this style. And lots of dukkha, lots of mind states and painful experience and frustration and confusion. And at one point, my mind was kind of just caught in it a little bit. It was caught in it. It was thinking about the suffering. And it was reflecting, you know, it's 2 weeks into the retreat. Normally, this long into a long retreat, my mind is more settled. This practice doesn't work. I probably shouldn't be doing this practice. I should pick up some of these tools, etc. So my mind was kind of bought into the idea of the suffering. But at some point, maybe just the being in the field of Sayadaw's emphasis on wisdom, that phrase, oh, this is suffering, popped in as, oh, that's what the Buddhist First Noble Truth is. That's what he said. This is suffering. Suffering happens. And the important reflection around suffering is that it should be understood. And so at some point in that kind of being caught in that mire of, oh, this can't be the right practice for me, my mind was like, oh, this is dukkha. Oh, this is dukkha. This is what the Buddha said we should understand. Oh, that's what's happening. This is dukkha. And so it was a real shift. The wisdom came in through the reflection. Actually, it started through an unskillful kind of reflection and then turned into the wisdom. And that too, the mind could, oh, that's what's happening. It's just dukkha that's arising. And so there's other language, perhaps, and I think you can find perhaps some language for yourself. For myself, there's a couple things that have arisen. One is, oh, this is just boredom. It's just confusion. Just the just in front of it kind of makes it more human. It's like, oh, this is what humans experience. It's not mine. And this is just another one that is kind of the flavor around the this is nature, the conditioned nature of experience. This kind of, oh, of course this is happening. The mind has done a lot of this in the past. Of course this is happening. I don't remember if we mentioned in the hall this phrase that the Buddha offered, that whatever one frequently ponders becomes the inclination of the mind. That's this understanding that whatever we have frequently conditioned, you know, that this is how conditioning works. When we frequently explore, investigate, get curious about things, the curiosity becomes more natural. If we engage a lot in picking up anger over and over again, that becomes very natural. It's a kind of a neutral mechanism in our minds, in our brains almost. It's the, you know, this, the way our brains work, as I understand it, is, you know, when something happens a lot in the mind, some pattern happens, is repeated a lot, the neurons basically go, oh, that one must be important. Let's add more neurons to that pattern. It needs help. And so the more we practice or the more we do something like anger, it's like the mind, and it's just simple kind of, it's a very neutral kind of mechanism. Oh, that must be important. Let's add some support to that anger pattern. And likewise, it'll do the same for a pattern around compassion and kindness and patience and mindfulness. That as we engage and practice with those, it supports those. But the great thing, so what we frequently ponder becomes the inclination of the mind. But the great thing is that our minds are malleable. You know, they're not those neurons that kind of come in and support that pattern, thinking, oh, that one's important. You know, if that pattern begins to be engaged with in a different way, if it's kind of the pattern put in neutral, like I talked about, you know, the car in neutral, the patterns in neutral, it's not being reinforced in the same way. And in fact, the way that it seems to work is when we put the mind in neutral. It's like that maybe reinforces the neutral pattern of mind, the one that's more interested in being curious and observing. And so as we engage in it in that way, it's like the support system for that pattern begins to see, oh, well, that maybe that one's not as important anymore. And over a period of time, it begins to weaken. And I have experienced this in my own practice, how the patterns can weaken when they're engaged with differently. Sometimes engaged with through the kind of putting it in neutral and just being with it, and sometimes through setting it aside. Because there is a place for that. If we find that we can't be present with something, and I'm going to go through a whole bunch of different ways to explore that, and I'd encourage trying those things first, but there are times when we can't do that. And it's just so strong. One particular pattern for me around anger, every time I tried to be with it, tried to meet it, I would just get sucked right back into that pattern. And so I began recognizing, yeah, this is not the time to be with that, and putting my attention on something else, just redirecting the attention, not in a repressing way, but much more in a kind and compassionate way to just, yeah, not the time right now. I see you're asking for attention, but mindfulness is not strong enough to meet this right now. And so I'm going to put my attention on something else. So just redirecting that particular pattern of anger around that particular situation. I did that with for a long time, probably at least a year. That particular pattern felt stronger than my ability to really meet it. But what happened over that year was that pattern started arising less frequently. I would still get caught when it happened. And, oh, step aside. But it was happening less. And then at one point, I kind of recognized or realized that it had been a while since I had felt that pattern. And even thinking about it, I couldn't find it. I couldn't find the anger at all. It was gone. It stayed gone. And so my sense of that is even the stepping aside, you know, that was a real learning for me, because I had always had the sense or the belief that in order for something to free in the mind, in order for something to let go, I had to look at it. I had to, like, you know, dive in there, figure it out, pull it apart. And here was a whole pattern of a particular anger at a particular person that disappeared when I was not looking. And so this is powerful. This is also a powerful tool. And my little tiny bit of understanding of neurobiology, you know, helps me to recognize that maybe what happened around that pattern was that the neurons began to see, yeah, that one's not so important. Yeah, we'll go somewhere else. So that is a way. You know, we don't have to look at something. But I do think that the non-repressing, it can't be a repressing kind of, if you're repressing the difficult state when you're redirecting the attention, that energy just gets submerged and reinforced in a way. It really has to be held with compassion and like, yep, I see you, and not now. So these tools of wise view, of bringing in wisdom reflections, can really support our minds to hold the pattern a little more, with a little more ease. Let's see if I had any others listed here. Oh, one came up in the hall the other day. Here's a good one. It will be okay. That's one that might be a support for us at times when we're feeling out of balance. So our mental struggles, the difficulties that we have, the patterns, are often, especially the habitual ones, the many layered, they're many layered. It's like there's habit on top of reaction on top of something else. It's just this like big mess of stuff that feels very dense and maybe even confusing at times. It's just like this big mess. It feels often like there's many layers, many threads to the difficulties, these habitual reactive patterns that we have. We all have our own flavor of this. If we can bring a sense of curiosity, and again, the confidence that it's not inherently a problem that this is happening. And that, in fact, as we've said, you know, these, whatever's arising, you know, the difficulties that are arising, the Buddha pointed to, understanding this suffering is the way to freedom. It's not, the aim here isn't to get rid of that pattern. It's to learn about it. The learning about it is what frees the mind. And so it's an interesting dynamic there, that we can't want it to be released while we're looking at it. But it does transform while we hold it with this mindfulness and wisdom. And so again, if we can remember, curiosity is a support for us in working with difficulty, that it is possible to be aware of anything, and that being aware of these difficulties is on the path. It is our path. There were so many retreats where in my early years where something challenging would come up, often anger related. Anger was my big go-to. It was like what I my mind had really frequently pondered. And often around anger, when that was coming up, oh, self-hatred, another big one. That was probably the biggest one. You know, and there was one particular retreat where self-hatred was coming up a lot. And it was just, it was very painful, and there was a kind of thing in my mind, and at some point I just said, well, I guess this is my self-hatred retreat. And that was a little bit of wisdom and a little bit of aversion in there, because it was what was arising, that was what was asking to be seen and known. And the little bit of aversion was the belief in there that this was somehow lesser practice. That it was kind of like, well, oh, well, I guess I'm not going to get enlightened this time. So I'll learn what I can from this. And so it's, you know, it was this like, you know, mind that was willing to be with it, but with the belief that somehow it wasn't the deeper kind of practice. And on that retreat, later on that retreat, it was quite interesting to, because I did ultimately just really like, okay, this is what I have to pay attention to. Kind of let go of the enlightenment goal for that retreat and just watched this pattern of self-hatred. Sometimes it'd be there, sometimes it wouldn't be. And then at one point, there was, and this was a key understanding, a key wisdom, a key insight in my practice, was there was a recognition of seeing at one point the self-hatred arising. There was a lot of work, and I'm going to talk about some of the tools that I learned along the way, but there was this moment when I saw the self-hatred arising and understood in that moment that it was just an arising, that it was just something the mind was making up. And it was a very deep understanding of the not-self nature of that pattern. And that helped me to understand right in that moment. It really kind of blew away that whole idea of, I guess this is lesser practice. Because it was a very profound insight into that understanding of not self, right in the midst of looking at self-hatred. So this is our path. It is, when these difficulties are arising, they're not in the way. They're what's presenting itself and asking for understanding, asking for wisdom. And so this is, again, some of this is view, it's understanding, it's perspective that can help us to not be so resistant, not have the aversion to these patterns. That mind that said, well, I guess this is my self-hatred to retreat. There was a little bit of a sense of, you know, kind of collapse, or a little bit of sense of, a little sense of aversion that, this isn't what I want to be dealing with. Fortunately, that mind was not the stronger mind. The stronger mind was at some point that curiosity of, I can be with this sometimes. Sometimes I have to turn aside. Sometimes I have to let it go and look out the window. That was one time I really felt like, I can't do anything here, but oh, I can look at the trees. You know, so just again, finding our way to be balanced. So some of this wisdom really supports us to have the trust and the confidence that it's possible to be with our experience. And so the Buddha's pointing in the First Noble Truth that we should understand our suffering, kind of brings in the understanding part around suffering is not a thinking about, not a trying to figure out, but the word in is often used is we need to investigate our experience, be curious about what's happening, what's the actual experience around this. But the word investigation itself is often, in our language, it makes us think about figuring out. And so that's not what we're trying to do. So I like actually just the words being with. When we, what investigation is really this kind of having our mindfulness be present with the experience, with some degree of curiosity. When that is the case, the mind does the investigation in a way. So our work is just to be with it. The understanding arises as we kind of let ourselves touch, meet the experience. So these habits, these patterns, these complex, messy things that we come in touch with, having a sense that it's complex and deep, you know, sometimes we might get a taste that there's something deep in the middle of whatever pattern it is. Maybe we have a sense that fear is right in the middle of all of this big, messy stuff. Maybe we've had a taste or an understanding that that's in there somewhere. And we might think, okay, I know that's in there, so let me like find the fear so that I can be with the fear, because I know that's really where the whole thing is coming from. But what's asking to be met? And then the way the practice works is just to meet what is most obvious, most a present on the surface of that big, messy ball of stuff. And sometimes I think of it just as a big, you know, ball, and it's like, okay, can I hold this just with wide arms? Not trying to dig in, pull it apart. I don't have my shawl with me, but I'll use my shirt. So sometimes the way that investigation feels, or this being with feels, is just like, you know, it's like a cloth that's polishing a bowl. It's just touching the surface. And it's got a soft quality, you know? It's just meeting what's there. And it's contacting it. It's rubbing it. That's the way investigation works, that being with. It's not about taking a hammer to this so that we can get inside the structure of it. It's much more, hold it, be with it. That being with reveals the many threads. That's kind of like the wide arms. You know, those patterns, those habits, that big messy thing that's going on. It's like a piece of it might rotate to the surface. And that's what you get to know in that moment. And then another few minutes later, something else comes to the surface, and that's what you get to know. So that the patience and just that being with. So I think sometimes, again, we have a view around what we're supposed to do with difficulty that makes it actually more painful to try to be with things. And so this is a much gentler approach, a patient approach to, oh, this is what's happening. Yes. What's here? What wants to come to me? What wants to show up? It's a very respectful way of dealing with difficulty. To not be so aggressive, to dig in and try to pull it apart and figure it out. I was really into that, you know. It's like, oh, this is what's happening. Let me like dive in. I'm going to like get in the microscope and figure it all out. And so much of that was motivated by aversion. It was motivated by wanting to get rid of it, as opposed to wanting to learn, have that curiosity around the experience. There's an analogy, I think, that's useful for the patience quality that's helpful with difficulty or with anything in our experience, actually. You know, as the difficulty begins to fall away and we're more just with the processes of body and mind, the same kind of patience is helpful. The kind of patience of being like a naturalist in nature. I mean, that's really what we are here. We are scientists investigating nature. But we're not the kind of scientists that go out into nature and cut the trees down and put the, you know, dig out some cells from the middle of the tree and then put it into a centrifuge and figure out. That's not the kind of scientists we are here. We're the kind of scientist that goes out and sits in nature and watches that redwood tree grow over the years and learn something about that redwood tree and about the climate and the ecosystem around that redwood tree and what animals take shelter in a redwood tree and when does a redwood tree thrive and what else happens around that redwood tree. It takes the patience to be willing to sit there and observe and be quiet and still because in nature, if we're going down cutting things down and, you know, shaking things around to say, what's in there? It's like everything's going to dive under their hole, under the holes in the ground. I'm not coming out. It takes a willingness to sit and let things feel safe to come out and come to you. And so being a naturalist, the sense of witnessing nature and patience with what is willing to show up right now, that's our mode of practice. It really does challenge our get something mind to do that. You know, that the mind that really wants to know quickly and figure things out. But it is so rewarding to do that. And the understanding that arises there is very organic and very natural. And mostly, I think usually, really ready to be seen and understood when we are approaching it in this way. What wants to come to us? So a few more tools when it is really hard to allow when these reflections and kind of looking at whether we have certain views that make us think it's not possible to be mindful of something. There are times when the patterns are stronger than our ability to really meet them. One tool that has been helpful for me that's kind of in between the one that is, oh, can't be with this right now, I need to turn my attention to something else, so the setting it aside is one. But there's a kind of an in-between kind of tool that is to kind of recognize or bring into mind and consciously perhaps recognize that this is not the only thing that's happening in the moment. Sometimes when we have a pattern like this, a difficult pattern, it's like we are under the water and it's like that's all that we're seeing. So when I was in Burma practicing with Sayadaw, there was a period where depression was coming up a lot. And it was pretty pervasive. And at some point, I recognized that it was helpful at times to just notice, yep, there's the depression. It wasn't necessarily always helpful to say, oh, there's the depression, and like let the mind meet it, because it was kind of pulled to it. Sometimes our mind can be pulled to something, gravitating to something, but it's not actually helpful. It's more of a habit and often an aversion, or it's like, you know, that thing. I got to figure out how to get rid of it. So, again, for me, it was very much an almost aversive kind of mind that was gravitating to that state of depression. And so rather than letting it do that, I kind of consciously recognized, okay, yeah, there's that depression and there's seeing happening. And there's hearing happening. And this body is sitting. Oh, and there's the depression again. And then there's seeing. And so kind of rotating through the senses in a way, acknowledging there's many thousands of other things going on besides this thing that the mind thinks is the whole world right now. So consciously expanding the container of the mindfulness to recognize and remember there's other things happening. Not trying to not go to that experience. In this case, the depression. I wasn't trying to keep it away, but I was just like letting my, there's that, and there's that, and there's that. Oh, and there's the depression, and there's that, and there's that, and there's that. to really help to kind of normalize the mind around that difficulty. It's not actually everything that's happening. So that was helpful. Another thing that I found, particularly for pervasive patterns, and this one, the one I was looking at in Burma, the depression was pervasive. It was there a lot. And it was a low-level depression. It wasn't a major depression, but it was just kind of this low-level feeling of. And so I began being curious about, again, just looking at it. I was just like, well, here it is. Okay, what's happening here? And I began to kind of just attune to three different qualities or states around the depression. There was when the depression was there, and it was okay. It's like, oh yeah, this is just. So that was that flavor where the mind had some space. It had that balance. It was able to have that sense of learning. Oh, this is just. Okay, that was one flavor. And then there was the knowing that I was depressed, but feeling caught by it. It's like a little bit immersed in it. There was an awareness there about it, but the mind was caught by the depression. It was believing the depression, believing it was a problem. It wasn't just, oh, this is depression. This can be seen. It's like, oh yeah, this is depression and it's a problem. So there was that kind of being caught by the depression. And so I began recognizing, oh, okay, well, this is what being caught by depression is like. And that actually was okay. And so I was in the place of being able to learn about what it felt like to be caught by depression. The mind could hold that part. So it was just like noticing, you know, depression is there. I'm caught, not caught. Caught, not caught. And then the other piece was when it vanished, when it went away, when the depression wasn't there. I mentioned this in the hall the other day. Sometimes it's useful with a pervasive pattern to consciously notice when it disappears. And this became very interesting around the depression because it would like, it's like it would be there for a little while, be, oh yeah, there it is. Oh, caught. Oh, not caught. And then it would vanish for a few moments and then it would be back. I'd be like, oh, there it is. Oh, caught, not caught. Caught, not caught, vanished. And it was really useful. Again, it pointed to this as being a process rather than me, rather than who I was. Those pervasive patterns we often strongly identify with, think that they're who we are. So that's a useful tool around a difficulty. Notice when it's present, when it's absent, and when it is present, is it that kind of present where it's like, oh yeah, I can learn with this? Or is it caught? And can you recognize, oh, caught is what's happening? That became a really helpful one. Oh, caught, okay. And that was like the of course the mind is caught by this. It's believed this for years. And then of course, to consciously step aside from the tool, the pattern, consciously turn your attention elsewhere if it's too strong. And sometimes that can be challenging in and of itself. How do I put my attention somewhere else when it's just like magnetized back to this thing? How does that work? It's like I try to put my attention on my breath and moments later it's back at it. So there's a tool that I found really useful that I shared in one of the groups this morning that I'll offer here, which is, it uses the power that our minds have to pay attention to something for just a moment. I think what we typically would do when we're trying to turn our attention away from something that's kind of magnetizing us is we'll turn to something else and try to stay with that one thing. But often, because our mindfulness doesn't always have the capacity to be with something and stay with it for long stretches of time. As the mindfulness weakens there, it just goes right back to that thing. And so this tool that I'm going to share with you, it uses the power that we have for just a moment to attend to something and then shift to something else. And so what I use is the visual field, which for many of us is an easy doorway to connect with. And in a room like this, I will find a corner, any place two lines come together. There are thousands of them in this room. It's not just the literal corners of the room. So, you know, this counts as a corner. This counts as a corner. You know, any place two lines come together. And so find a corner, and let's do this together in the room. So find a corner and look at a corner just for a second. So connect, know that you're looking at it. And that's all you got to do. It's like, yep, that's a corner. And then switch to another one. And then switch to another one. So about once a second, switch to a corner. And it's helpful to move your head as you do this. So another corner. Another corner. We'll do this for like 15 seconds. Find a corner and then switch. 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 So it may not have been quite long enough, but some of you may have had a sense of, I mean, I did in just like the last 2 or 3 seconds. Felt a little bit of a whoo, a little bit of a relaxing of the mind. And this is, you know, this is the power of continuity of mindfulness, that even 15 seconds of that and then that and then that and having something very clear to land on, our mind can effectively begin to demagnetize that pull that kind of latches us back. Because we're, you know, it's like, it's almost like each time we switch, it might be going back. It's like, no, that thing, no, that thing. And so it really helps the mind to let go of that. And if you do that even for 90 seconds, it will substantially weaken the pull of that kind of difficulty. And then you may be able to put your attention on something else for a while, or maybe even let it be one of many things that's present in the present moment. So, another kind of belief that happens, and this can be around particular states of mind. I mean, sleepiness is a classic one for this, that we, again, I mentioned earlier, we sometimes have the belief that it's not possible to be mindful in certain states, and sleepiness is kind of classic for that. Well, how can I possibly be mindful of sleepiness? And it is just a belief. It's way more possible than you can imagine how deeply the mindfulness can connect to sleepiness. And so, you know, there's these views and beliefs that if this is happening, if this experience is happening, I can't be mindful. And that often happens with sleepiness. I'm too sleepy to meditate. I would like to propose to you that if you have that thought and know that you're having that thought, that you already have awareness of the sleepiness. And that's enough of an awareness to meditate, to be with that sleepiness. Typically what's going on there is that we think we've got some other idea, some other agenda for what being mindful means, what meditating means. It means that I'm supposed to be able to attend to all of the sounds and body sensations, and everything's supposed to be really clear. And sometimes that sense of what it's supposed to be like when we're meditating comes from some of those first tastes we have of really clear meditation. And so sleepiness is not that. And when we're sleepy, it's often not possible to really connect with all of these various sensations. You know, but it is possible to know sleepiness. It's like fog, you know, the fog on days here when it's really foggy, you look out the window and you can't see much. You know, if you've got the agenda to see those trees as clearly as we can see them right now, it's going to be really frustrating when it's foggy. But you can clearly know the fog. You can see the fog. And in fact, we know the fog by how it obscures things. You know, that's the way fog is. The nature of fog is obscuring. And that's what we see. That's what we know. And actually, it can be beautiful. We're not trying, if we're not trying to see clearly what the trees look like, we can just appreciate the mist and appreciate the way it feels soft and obscured. Similarly with our minds. We can know that state of, oh, this is sleepiness. Wow. It's like, it feels like a mist, maybe. It seems like we're surrounded by cotton balls, like there's not much that we can land on. That's okay. Can you know that mist of sleepiness? Anytime you have a thought, something like, I'm too X to meditate. I'm too sleepy. I'm too restless. There's not enough energy. Explore what it might be to turn to, okay, well, there's not enough energy to attend to experience in the way I'd like to, but what does it feel like to know there's low energy? This is what it feels like to have low energy. And you having that thought, oh, I'm too X to meditate, you already have a sense, you already have a flavor of what that experience is to be aware of that experience. So truly, whatever is arising, whatever's coming up, that is our opportunity for learning. There's always something to learn with whatever is arising. And that learning is what supports the growth of that wisdom. And the wisdom is what lets the mind let go of its habits, of its patterns, of the ways that it holds on and clings and pushes away. It's the learning that supports the wisdom, and the wisdom that allows the letting go. We can't do the letting go, but we can let ourselves be with and let the learning happen. So let's just sit for a moment.